Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. It's Legal Roundtable Day, and there's lots to talk about. Our regular attorneys, SIU Carbondale Journalism Professor Bill Freivogel, and Washington University Associate Vice Chancellor of Students and Career Center Director Mark Smith, are joined by Mike Wolf, former Missouri Supreme Court Chief Justice and outgoing Dean of the St. Louis University School of Law. Gentlemen, thanks so much for being with us.
Hi.
Afternoon.
Mike, nice to see you, and this is your swan song as dean on this program, but I hope it's not the last time you're here.
Well, thank you.
Okay, let's start with, it's not actually breaking news, but it is new news, and that is the fact that the feds are now investigating allegations of voter fraud in the city of St. Louis. This all stems from the primary election in St. Louis in the 78th Legislative District. There was some absentee ballot irregularities. Now, Jennifer Joyce has turned this over without real explanation to the U.S. attorney. Mike Wolf, what might be the significance of it's going to the feds?
Well, first of all, I have to say we're in a fact-free zone here because we don't really know.
Exactly.
I think a couple things. One,
it's never stopped us before.
And it's good for contemporary politics. The allegations, and there was quite a good reporting in the Post-Dispatch by Doug Moore and somebody else who did this piece on, they went out and talked to people who had voted absentee, and they either didn't remember voting absentee or they signed something they didn't know what it was. That's really where you can get some fraudulent activity in terms of the voting. What it did, I think, at the time was, and it was quite a big story, and they had the new election, and Bruce Franks beat Representative Hubbard in the rerun primary, was that it fed into the notion that there's a lot of voter impersonation fraud at the polling place. Across the nation, they've detected almost none of that. But it's a theme because they want people to have photo IDs. We voted on that in November, so we've now approved a constitutional amendment which validates a change in the law that will require people to have photo IDs. I assume there'll be some lawsuits about that, whether that is disadvantaging minorities and so forth. So, but in terms of the turning it over to the feds, I assume they did some follow-up investigation and maybe they have some information related to whether or not those votes legitimately were cast in the August primary.
Mm-hmm. Well, there we are. I mean, we don't know
the
anymore.
The other thing it could be is, you know, what they kind of did the new election over was the fact that they weren't in the envelopes. And these absentee ballots, there are lots of hoops you have to jump through. And if you've got a sloppy organization, now that seemed like it was a more forgivable sin and one that maybe other people were doing. But say you go out and collect a bunch of ballots and then notarize them later. I mean, that's the kind of stuff where there'll be criminal charges then. And so who knows what like you said, when they went out and started talking to people, what they found out about the process.
I think that Jennifer Joyce saying that she's got additional information and asking the U.S. attorney to sort of take over the investigation and him doing so indicates that they feel they have, you know, pretty serious evidence. You know, I agree with Mike that you shouldn't confuse this to meaning that there's lots of voter impersonation fraud. Absentee ballots are something that can be abused, and there's every reason, given the different outcomes in the two elections here, there's every reason to believe that it was abused in this instance. You know, Dave Rowland, who's been our guest a couple of times, I think he looked at 15 years of voting patterns in this area and found lots of evidence, he thought, of abuse of absentee ballots. So I wouldn't be surprised to see some sort of criminal charge come out of this.
You know, I've never voted absentee, but what sort of identification do you need to receive an absentee ballot?
Same thing that you have at the polls, and that is you, under current law, until this photo ID kicks in, you could bring a utility bill or whatever, and actually the fact, if you had a mailed-in ballot, they would mail it to your house. So you're the registered voter at that house, and it comes to you, and then you sign it. One of the loopholes.
Doesn't it have to be notarized, or is that not the case anymore?
Except unless you're disabled.
Oh, okay.
So all of these people whose ballots were turned in mass, apparently, an awful lot of them, according to the newspaper story, were people who were disabled. So there were a lot of people disabled in that particular housing complex that that one of the Hubbards ran.
And who told the Post-Dispatch that they hadn't been disabled. No. They weren't disabled.
And I think then Representative Hubbard's husband brought in a whole bunch of them at once.
That was the allegation, yes.
Which kind of raised some eyebrows, too. Just one other question about absentee. When the voter ID law is in effect, will people have to show a photo ID to receive an absentee ballot?
I'm not sure. I think because, again, they're mailing it to your house. And it's the house that's on your photo, I mean, not your on your voter registration. You may have to, if you're a new registrant, you may have to identify yourself that way to register. But I'm not sure that they'll insist on that because except for disabled people, you'll have to have it notarized, which means that you're presenting yourself to a notary public.
Right, and typically you would identify yourself. Yeah, so right. I was a notary for a while. Yeah, and I would have to write down why I was.
Right.
And so it was driver's license or something, right? Mm-hmm.
Well, obviously, we'll all be watching that. An interesting twist in the voter fraud allegations. Moving along to something else, the American Tort Reform Foundation has said that St. Louis is number one judicial hellhole in the country. Pardon my language, but it's not mine, really. It's this organization's. What is that? I mean, what is going on here? Why are we so proclaimed? Anybody have any thoughts about that?
Well, this report that comes out regularly by an industry group. I'm sure they have good points, and you know, it may be that the particular suit that they pointed to in St. Louis, where there was a large judgment of a class action of women who got ovarian cancer, and the allegation, based upon possibly not the greatest scientific evidence, it was from talcum powder. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe they have a good point there. But in general, this is an industry group that wants to reduce the kind of damages that people can win in courts. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, and they've come up with this handy little judicial hellhole phrase that they use for St. Louis and for Madison County at times. And you know, I'm not going to defend all of the practices in St. Louis and Madison County, but I definitely think that their quote unquote reforms that they point to in places like West Virginia, where you know the corporations got control of the courts, they're not really reforms. They're just ways to try to keep from having to pay big judgments.
These, in particular, they cited the three cases that went to verdict in an individual. Who had claimed that they were, but they or their loved one had developed ovarian cancer from talcum powder made by Johnson & Johnson. And so you've got three cases heard by jurors. So you got 36 jurors in the city who have heard the evidence and said this actually was caused. They were persuaded. There was probably scientific evidence on both sides. Oftentimes these cases have what I've heard lawyers refer to as bad paper. And that is that there's company records that show that someplace along the line they knew that this product was linked to or causing
tobacco,
asbestos, this kind of thing. So that bad paper, when it comes out in a trial, these are 12 people who have been subjected to quite a bit of scrutiny in terms of being selected as jurors. And they see something, and with these punitive damages awards, they're mad, they're angry. They see something that they think is wrongdoing. And so I agree with what Bill said about, well, yeah, they want to do that. In fact, in Madison County, they went so far as to start a newspaper over there, the Madison Record, which documents, and I put that in quotes, the activities that lead to bad tort results. And by the way, they're quite upfront about it. The newspaper itself says it's put out by whatever this chamber group is or whatever.
So these were probably, outlier decisions. But, I mean, this seems to be a marketing ploy by kind of the defense bar to say, you know, judicial hellhole. People will report that. They'll talk about it in the newspaper. And then now with a Republican governor and a Republican legislature, you'll have another push for tort reform, however, and tort reform can mean a lot of different things. Mm-hmm. But they'll be, I'm sure they'll be citing, look at St. Louis City has become a judicial hellhole. We have to change this. And, you know, I think it's more complicated and it's more nuanced than they're going to try and make it.
I think it's also fair to say that I'm pretty sure in these talcum powder cases, they have not had rulings on motions about the new trial motions by the defense, nor have them in appeals. So these are just three
just
decisions
first
by three juries in the city of St. Louis, and there's a long way to go. I mean, as that documentary about the McDonald's $178 million scalding case showed, you know, it ended up being about $1.5 million or something. So juries can get excited about this because that's their purpose, and that is to judge the justice in the case.
You know, go ahead. One of the reforms that the groups of this kind are always pushing are caps on damages. And, you know, we've talked a couple of times recently about the late Rick Titelman. And, you know, Rick wrote the Missouri Supreme Court decision that found that some of those caps could not be imposed because they were unconstitutional because they took away the person's right to have a jury come up with a – you know, judge the case. And I imagine we're going to have more pushes to reinstate caps.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You mentioned Judge Titelman, the late Judge Titelman. We had a conversation about him shortly after his death. I wanted to just bring that up because there has been a decision made that now, and Mike, you talked about this last time, now the governor-elect Greitens is going to be the one who will make the choice
Certainly.
About his successor.
And that's appropriate. That's how the system works. And I think that he has not made anything explicit about the kinds of people he wants. I think when governors take on the notion that they ought to tell the commissions whom they want, who they want, they hardly ever get that. But I do think that the commission, which is three lawyers elected by members of the bar, three lay people, non-lawyers, who are appointed by the governor, not necessarily the governor that's in office.
Yeah,
he'll get some appointments as time goes on, and the Chief Justice. I think that they should pay attention to who the governor is and give him people that he would be happy to appoint. And I think the system works best when it does that. It worked very well when Carnahan became governor after the period of 8 years of John Ashcroft. It worked not so well when Governor Blunt took over in 2005.
Right.
I hope it works this time.
And Breckinridge will chair the committee, and she was the one that Blunt had to end up choosing. He was very unhappy with the panel of lawyers that came before him. And in this case, we're going to have, I checked, three of the members are appointed by Governor Nixon. Now, one's term is up at the end of this year, so if Greitens wanted to drag his feet a little bit, could maybe appoint a new, you know, replace this person pretty quickly. So then you have three lawyers that are picked through the Bar Association, and then you've got the three citizens, and then you got the Missouri Supreme Court.
Interestingly,
justice.
I think that's a Nixon appointment because it's
comes
Nixon before appointment? The before the 9th of January, which is when Greitens becomes governor. But I remember in 1992 and 93. That we had some trade-offs with the outgoing governor, and one of the trade-offs was that they left the appointment of the Appellate Judicial Commission.
And I mean, Nixon's had
governor.
So many unfilled positions, and I mean, so I'm appointed to a statewide board. My term was up, I don't know, 2 years ago. I'm still serving because they haven't appointed. And I think what I've heard is Nixon liked doing this because then, say I do something really bad, he doesn't have to ask me to resign. He just appoints a new guy, and then I'm gone, and the problem goes away. So who knows if he'll act? I would be betting he doesn't.
And there's about 2,000 or 3,000 of those appointments.
Exactly.
You know,
there's
a board of boiler inspectors. There's a board of this and a
Mine's
board of
that. Mine's not as important as oil inspector.
I've got to take a break, but very quickly, if Governor Greitens appoints someone who is super conservative, what does that do to the court? Does that change the flavor of the court?
Every court, and I served on the court where everybody was replaced during my time there except for one position. So there were five new judges that came along. Every time there is one new judge, it becomes a different group.
Oh, really? Yeah.
And it's really, it's a very interesting process. I can't really explain everything about it, but if you look at the data, and I was thinking about this the other day, when I left the court, the previous Scott Lauk at the Missouri Lawyers Weekly keeps track of the data, and we were running about 85% of our decisions were unanimous. Now we have a different group of people there, and it's over 50%, but it's much less than 85% unanimity. I don't know why that is. It's just a different group of people. It functions. Each one is an organism, and it functions differently depending on whether you have this person, this group of seven, or a different, or one change one, and you've got to change entity.
Yeah, interesting, interesting. That's Mike Wolfe, who was the outgoing dean of the St. Louis University Law School. He's part of our Legal Roundtable panel, which is comprised also of Bill Freivogel and Mark Smith. Back to continue our conversation in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Now to our legal panel discussion with Mark Smith, Bill Freivogel, and Mike Wolfe. I wanted to talk for a moment about the settlement between the Family Court of St. Louis County and the Department of Justice. Basically, they've reached a deal which centered primarily on the treatment of juvenile defendants in the court. And from what I've been able to read, it seems pretty clear that young people were actually treated in disproportion to young blacks in particular, to young whites. It took 16 months for this agreement to be reached. Why, I wonder, Bill, do you have any sense of why it would take so long? It seemed pretty cut and dry.
Well, no, I don't. I don't know why it took so long. I do think that it seems like the settlement that was agreed upon. And one reason it might have taken so long is they didn't make all of the changes that some of the advocates for the juveniles were calling for. So it was sort of a half a loaf kind of settlement.
Right.
So that might have been one of the reasons. I mean, the main things that they did were to double, I take it from like one to two, the number of public defenders available to represent indigent juveniles. They seem to have they're going to reinforce the right of juveniles to remain silent by keeping police from questioning them unless there is a lawyer present. So those are two of the main reforms. Also, the juvenile. The deputy juvenile officers their role is being, it appears to me, limited to some extent. I mean, they're the people who are sort of like officers of the court who handle the case, and so like if they hear an admission by a juvenile, they're not supposed to pass that admission along to the court, if I understand the procedure right. I think that so May Quinn was one of the persons who challenged this, who went to the Justice Department to say that they had unconstitutional procedures.
Washington University
former
Law
Washington
School,
U
yeah.
law professor. Now
no,
she has
to
a
MacArthur,
separate,
right?
Yes, a yep. separate legal advocacy organization, and she argues that still.
Right.
There's still like a separation of powers problem in that, who do all these people, answer to? Some are sort of legislative and some are sort of judicial, and that it's sort of a mess and unconstitutional still. So she thinks there's some improvements, but that it's still an unconstitutional system.
And that may be the reason it took so long. And also, what they're trying to do with this juvenile justice system is do what's in the best interest of the child, but it's also an adversarial system. So you have two different approaches that don't mesh, and so it's really hard to kind of work something out. Do you want to make it just a criminal system and then forget that they're kids and not try and do something to help them, or do you want to try and help them, but then what about their right against self-incrimination and all that kind of stuff?
Many years ago when I was a legal services lawyer, I was quite distrustful of juvenile courts. I'm not sure quite what they saw themselves as being, because in a sense they are social agencies.
Right. Right.
They are trying to help the children, as Mark said. On the other hand, they are part of the criminal justice system. You have a cap on the number of years that you can deal with somebody who's a juvenile. Some of the disparate treatment that occurs can be solved, I think, by having more lawyers in there who are representing actual clients, and I think that would be very helpful for those who don't have a parental structure or a family structure available to be there to advocate for them. So in the sense, everybody who serves as, and there's been some very good people I've known who've been juvenile judges, but they always have this kind of tension. Am I a judge or am I helper? And I think in some cases you really get disadvantaged if you don't have the kind of family support, family structure, and that's really where you need a lawyer because you're going to get in much, much more serious trouble. You're going to be much more likely to be bound over into the adult system.
And then the other thing that's further complicating things that we haven't talked about is cost. I mean, if you bring in more lawyers, they're expensive. I think they were saying something like this is going to increase costs by like $150, $135, something, which I was kind of surprised. That seemed rather low estimate to me. Right. So I'm not sure how they're doing that.
I'm getting a sense from what you're all saying that they may have a long way to go still out there in the county. Is that what we're concluding?
I think they've got an agreement. I think Mae Quinn has got this in her sights and will continue with this MacArthur Foundation looking at this, and I wouldn't be surprised if we're not talking about this again in 2 years.
Okay. We have a caller who wants to get in, and before we proceed much farther than where we are right now, let's bring in Susan calling from Illinois. She probably wants to discuss something we already have discussed, so let's see. Susan, go ahead. Susan?
Thank you. I'm glad you touched on you were going into that earlier. I discovered to my surprise that when we were preparing to sue a nursing home, it's apparently fairly common knowledge among lawyers that even if you win your lawsuit, you're not going to get anything because who knows who owns it and where are they? They cannot be contacted. You'll never find out who they are. And you're not going to get any kind of award. I've seen some high-handed, if not outrageous, behavior. And I've been told by the Department of Aging, I was told back then that they were way overloaded. The entire southern part of Illinois is handled by one individual in the Department of Aging. And I've just been shocked again and again.
All right, Susan, thank you for
the whole landscape.
Thank you for the call, Mark.
Well, she points to two problems, or at least two problems. One is that justice is not quick, and the legal system takes a long time. Second thing is you can win a verdict of $1.5 million. That doesn't mean the person that you have it against, or the entity more likely that you have it against, has the assets to pay it. There are people and organizations that are judgment-proof. So when I'm driving down South Grand Boulevard on a Saturday night at like 10 o'clock with my kids and I see like a rusted-out 78 Impala and I know the guy's drinking while he's driving, I always point out, and there's Rust-Oleum on the side, I point to the kid and say, look at that guy's judgment-proof. He doesn't care about anything.
That's the kind of thing you say to your kids.
Yeah, I'm giving him life lessons in the car on a Saturday night.
But he's not taking care of old people in a nursing home.
Thank goodness. Yeah, but he's judgment-proof, and if he hits you, you know, he's going to be liable, but it doesn't matter.
And how old is your child?
Well, I've got him. You never choose. Even the 9-year-old gets that lesson.
They're saying, what is Dad talking about?
Yeah, this is when they roll their eyes.
Yeah.
You know, if I understood the sort of the sentiment of the caller, I think she makes a good point that you shouldn't get the idea from these hellhole designations that like the American judicial system is all rigged against corporations because it isn't. Yeah. And it's, you know, it's not easy to win judgments against nursing homes or shell corporations. And so
They've got the money.
And they've got good lawyers defending
them. That's what they use the money for. Exactly. I mean, that's what I'm talking about. Okay, let's
give me some money. I'll go to the Cayman and find that money.
Yeah, pretty soon you're going to be able to do just that if you like. All right, moving along. We've got lots to cover yet. The next one I have here is the Wilson grand juror suit. That's the grand juror unidentified in the Darren Wilson case concerning the shooting death of Michael Brown in August of 2014. The juror wanted to be able to talk about what had transpired during the grand jury session, and the law, I guess, or rules, regulations say that that can't happen. Why is exactly was she not allowed to speak?
You know, I followed this a bit, and I think you wrote on it, Bill,
yeah,
so maybe
yeah,
I'll start with you.
The grand jurors take an oath of secrecy, right. and this particular grand jury took that oath twice. So this is – she's represent – she keeps being referred to as she. I'm not actually sure it's a she. The grand juror, Doe, is represented by the ACLU, and they, you know, they claim that – the grand juror should have a First Amendment right to be able to talk about what she saw and about what the juror saw. And especially that's true given that the reasons for secrecy are diminished by the fact that McCullough released the transcripts and made public statements about how the grand jury process worked, and that so that the grand juror should no longer be bound by this oath. Now, a federal court, I think it was Rodney Sipple, mm-hmm. said, well, the federal government has to abstain from this because first we've got to figure out what do the state laws about grand jury secrecy mean. And then now we have a state court ruling saying that this grand juror has not presented enough reasons to get out of the oath. But the court did note, and Mike, maybe you can confirm this because I think you told me this the first time, is that if the grand juror were to speak, I don't believe that there is a criminal law.
I think isn't there a statute that makes a Class A misdemeanor?
Yeah, it does. There is a criminal statute, okay. but she could speak in, say, the city of St. Louis. The question is, would the prosecutor, and that's where she would be committing the, quote, crime, would the prosecutor prosecute her? I don't know. But I thought there was a disconnect between what Judge Sipple, when he abstained from hearing, because it was a First Amendment challenge, and he said, I think we want to hear from the state courts as to whether this is vital, because, you know, what is the state interest here? It's hard for a federal judge to figure that out. But the question that was answered in the state court proceeding that threw out her case in the state court was a different question. The judge said, well, she didn't show why she should have to talk. Well, I don't think that's the right question. I think the question is, what is the state's interest? So it seems to me that it might very well be a good idea, since this is a challenge to the statute itself, the validity of the statute. This case could go directly to the Missouri Supreme Court. Now, the ACLU lawyers have I think, strategically decided that they want the First Amendment issue decided in a federal court. So they're not going to litigate the First Amendment issue in the state Supreme Court or the state courts. They are litigating the issue of, well, what does the statute mean? Is it vital to the state's interest that she continue to be silent? Once that's decided, then they can go back to the federal court. But I do think that the trial court in St. Louis County, who's a very thoughtful judge, that's not the whole answer.
We should point out, by the way, that and we keep saying she. I guess that's all right. Whatever.
We're in a factory zone.
basically what she wanted to do was to open a dialogue on improving race relations. That was her motive. Apparently insufficient.
I think that was part of it. But I thought I recall part of it too was this person was saying, "Look, these facts came out, and other people know I was on that grand jury, and I need to explain myself to family and friends." I think that was part.
But you're right, Don, in saying that she did say that she thought.
Yeah.
The juror said that by describing what had happened, that would lead to better understanding of how the grand jury had acted and be advantageous towards race relations in St. Louis.
So, Mike, were you suggesting that if this juror disclosed the facts in the city of St. Louis, the prosecutor in the county couldn't prosecute?
I'm not sure. But where's the crime committed?
Well,
it's committed where the crime is committed. I mean, I think if you asked McCullough, would you prosecute her if she stood down on the steps of the City Hall in St. Louis and said this?
No.
And then it appears on the TV and radio, and it's all in St. Louis County.
Well, where do you commit the crime? Uh-huh. I mean, you're prosecuted where the crime is committed.
Knowing Bob McCullough, he'd probably try to.
I don't know if he ever answered that question.
Yeah. Let's take another break. Come back. We've got still more to talk about, obviously, and we'll do that when we come back. It's our Legal Roundtable panel comprised of Bill Freivogel, Mike Wolf, and Mark Smith. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Welcome back as we continue our legal discussion. Bill Freivogel, you brought to our attention yesterday something put out by the Brookings Institution concerning the Emoluments Clause, which is so much in discussion now concerning our president-elect and the fact that he has all of these holdings and how they can be interpreted and conflict of interest and all the rest of it. It seems to me in my reading of what the Brookings did was they made a very strong case for impeachment of Donald Trump.
Well, they made a strong case that there would be potentially an impeachable offense if Donald Trump doesn't do the things that they think he has to do to avoid the emoluments clause of the Constitution. So this was a paper that was written by a bunch of legal hotshots, including Lawrence Tribe from Harvard, whose name is sort of familiar. And so they were saying, this is about the Emoluments Clause, which is Article 1, Section 9 of the Constitution. It says any person holding any office of profit or trust under the United States can't receive, quote, any present emolument, office, or title of any kind from any king, prince, or foreign state. So they were saying emolument would include any kind of financial benefit. And that language of any kind, it makes clear that we're supposed to be talking about this very broadly. And their bottom line is that the only way in which President-elect Trump can avoid violating the Emoluments Clause is for him and his children to divest themselves not only of control but any financial interest in the enterprise. I'm sure they're not going to do that. I mean, I don't think we even know whether Trump will divest himself of his financial interest in the enterprise. So, yes, I mean, if you assume he's not going to do what they say he has to do, that would potentially be an impeachable offense. That doesn't mean it you couldn't have a U.S. attorney file a criminal complaint, but it would be up to the Congress to decide whether to impeach him. Most likely, this Congress would not, I would guess.
Well, he has business dealings in India, Philippines, Scotland, Turkey, and other places.
Russia.
Russia.
That's true.
These are not princes or potentates that he's dealing with. I mean, he claims that this doesn't apply to him.
Yeah. So these legal scholars are saying that it relates to any kind of a foreign agent, so benefit from any kind of foreign entity. It's not just limited to the state actor.
But the bottom line is, again, as I read it, is if he enters office knowingly in violation of these things, as they suggest that he is, that he is subject to impeachment. I mean, right from the get-go.
That's what these. In fact, one of them is Richard Painter, who was the White House Ethics Counsel during the George W. Bush administration. There's also, and I would point out that there's some folks that have raised the issue relating to something called the Stock Act. And you have to kind of just think back, not 200 years, but only about a few years ago, when people got very upset that people in Congress and people who worked on congressional staffs were getting inside information, using that information to develop their own business opportunities or stock purchases or whatever. And so Senator Kirsten Gillibrand of New York sponsored a bill called the Stock Act, and it was passed rather overwhelmingly that says you can't trade on inside information, on any information you get in your governmental capacity. You can't use that to benefit yourself in a financial way. You can't use that money to be making money. And the headline of the piece that I saw in the Huffington Post said, this is the law that poses the greatest threat to Donald Trump, because look at the wealth of information you get about business dealings all over the world, and you get that, and it's your, and by the way, this law covers your family as well. So, and the violation of the law is a felony. So there you go. You're back to impeachment, because I'm not sure whether a sitting president can be indicted.
Because an impeachment is it's a political, so it's indictment. Not like a legal. Mm-hmm. Although, when I read this Brookings thing, there was some suggestion, and I didn't really understand that, that maybe a private citizen could bring a private cause of action. But it sounded like it was almost like for a declaratory judgment to just say he's in violation of the Emoluments Clause, but I don't know that anything would happen.
I don't see any federal court ordering Congress to do something.
No, like they're not going to order Congress, right. But more to say this is a violation of this.
They'll find that citizen doesn't have standing because his interest is no different than any of the others.
Well, citizens. They were saying that they addressed that, but I was kind of with you. I not convincingly, I didn't think.
I think standing, now we're getting out into the weeds, is what the court says it is for its own protective purposes. Well, that is, we don't want to decide this case.
I think the takeaway is if President-elect Trump continues to go forward in the way he says he's going to go forward, he's probably in violation of the Emoluments Clause in the Constitution. It's an impeachable offense, but I don't think anything's going to happen.
If they start a proceeding, will they get his tax records?
So is this just an exercise in the law and legalities, or is this as serious as it sounds like it could be?
Well, I think it is just that. I mean, it would be an exercise in futility because the Republicans control the Congress.
Well, wait a minute. There's a few that are I think somewhat. But I mean, this really gets down to a question, it seems to me, of the interests of the country. And there's right now what we're talking about and the way people are talking about has to do with a partisan interest. And if it stays a partisan question, then it goes nowhere.
Yeah. Right.
But if it gets down to whether this is something that really involves the best interests of the country, then the question is patriotism. Mm-hmm. Then the question is the national interest. That brings you a whole lot of Republicans into the game. So as long as it's still framed as a partisan issue, it's not going anywhere. But as soon as it becomes a national interest issue, it might go somewhere.
I mean, Democrats and people in the middle were never able to get the electorate aroused enough to demand that Trump release his tax returns. And my sense is that, barring some scandals that actually flesh out the effect of this kind of conflict, that barring additional information, that we're still not going to be able to arouse enough American people to force Trump to divest himself of his interest in his business. That's just my gut feeling. I think he should.
But if he doesn't, is he in violation of the Constitution?
Well, I think the way these legal scholars interpret it, and I think they make a lot of sense, I think he would be in violation of the Constitution, but only the Congress can do anything about it.
You know, the other thing is that you're never going to get the public unanimously on this, because I remember from many years ago, after Richard Nixon resigned in disgrace, that somewhere around 25% of the people thought he had been wrongly accused.
Yeah, right.
and now, Trump is saying, I've won one of the biggest landslides in history.
Right. I could have won the popular vote if I'd tried. Yeah. Maybe
if there hadn't been so much voter fraud.
Right.
Yeah. Well, 25% of the people believe that.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, most people either don't know or they disbelieve it, but you're always going to have 25%.
There are similar kinds of numbers out there with regard to the number of people who care about any of this. So,
right.
So there you go.
And this is a pretty obscure area of the law.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure I even remember hearing about the emolument clause until about a couple of months ago.
I think it was something you wash your mouth out with.
Yeah. Maybe I got that question wrong on the bar exam or something because I don't know.
Well, let's leave that to Congress then to sort it out after January 20th. Let's take a call. Mike wants to take us back to a discussion point or two from a few moments ago, so let's bring him in and then move on. Mike, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, I just want to touch base again on some of the juvenile issues that you discussed. And one is whether minors or juveniles have the same Miranda rights as adults. Having worked with some kids and things previously, teenagers, I don't really know that they always get Mirandized. And my concern comes where kids may talk to the police, and then later, because of the what they're involved in, are determined to be certified as an adult, and whether any information gained then, if they haven't really been Mirandized, is can be used against them. Because basically, you know, if they're not given the same rights and they freely give up information, you know, I guess I have some concerns with that.
Thank you so much for the call, Mike. Bill?
Well, I mean, having read this settlement with the county juvenile court, I believe that they're taking as many steps as they feel like they can to try to protect a juvenile's ability to remain silent and to not be questioned by the police without a lawyer present. So that definitely is a major portion of the settlement agreement. You know, as to exactly does a juvenile have a Miranda right to remain silent, I'm not 100% sure.
They probably have a right to have a parent there.
Yeah, a parent or a lawyer, right. And I would also imagine that once you switch from the – once again, I don't know this, but since we're not letting facts get in the way of our strongly held opinions, you know, that once you go over to the adult system, I would suspect if you made some kind of statement as a juvenile – and you weren't given the protections that an adult would receive, I would assume that would not be admissible. I mean, because, you know, the courts are pretty good about protecting our rights that way.
You can suppress the statement for the use in the criminal proceeding, but at the same time, the police might have gotten useful information from the juvenile by having that conversation and finding out what's going on, who's the next person we need to talk to.
Right.
So the way the settlement reads is this is to protect the juvenile's privilege against self-incrimination, and it says that the juvenile court agrees that the policies, procedures, and practices will be put in place to prohibit police interrogations in the juvenile detention center unless an attorney is present to represent the juvenile.
In the juvenile detention center, not necessarily on the street.
Right. Okay. Mike, I hope that answers your question. Moving on to something else now, and I know, Mike, this is an area in which you have some interest and certainly expertise, and that concerns the charter school, former city charter school student, family moved to the county. He wants to go back into the city charter school, and they're not going to let him. He's claiming this is a violation of his constitutional rights. What do you make of this case?
Well, the interesting thing about it is that we have the remedy in place from the desegregation settlement, which was the end of the desegregation litigation that went on from the 1980s with the interdistrict transfer law, which allows white students from the county to go to school in city schools. It allows black students to go to schools in the county, and so there is a racial criterion for...
This is a black student, by the way.
Right, and this is a black student who is going to school at the charter school in the city, then his family moved to Maryland Heights. He's in the Pattonville district. Mm-hmm. If he were white, he could go to that charter school, mm-hmm. but he's not white, he's black. And so... the question is, does that unravel the remedy? This is a court-protected racial preference, and that's what I think it's the Pacific Legal Foundation who represents him is going forward with. In all of these things, the money follows from where the kid comes from. So if it's a white kid in the Pattonville district, the kid goes to school in the city gets the money from Pattonville, which is both state aid and local aid. Or local resources, but it is protected under the settlement agreement, but it just remains to be seen whether that gets tossed aside, because the desegregation remedy is winding down, and I think you'll probably have a legislature looking at various kinds of school choice that may make this a more neutral way of approaching it, but it really has to come as a legislative solution, it seems to me.
I mean, the Pacific Legal Foundation is one of these very successful and conservative legal advocacy organizations, and they think they've found their test case here. They make the very extraordinary claim that the entire desegregation program from the get-go was unconstitutional. Mm-hmm. Because it had racial distinctions, but it was initially a remedy for segregated schools. It was a consent decree that was a remedy, and the remedies have got to have racial classifications in order to remedy the racial segregation that existed.
That was government sponsored.
That was government imposed. Yeah. And then the settlement agreement that Mike was just talking about in 1999, I mean, that's an agreement amongst the parties to try to continue to bring about desegregation of schools in the St. Louis area. St. Louis has not yet been declared to be unitary. In other words, desegregated. So this is a consent decree that all the parties agreed to. If they want to challenge that, they go to court and challenge the consent decree. They're not really challenging that directly. And just my overall view is, they've wrapped themselves in this. Martin Luther King said this, and the desegregation plan is nothing more than more Plessy versus Ferguson. Segregation is legal. I mean, that is just – it's an outrageous claim, I think.
Well, you've got Chief Justice John Roberts, I think, is believing that the problems of racial discrimination are over. He said so.
Yeah, he said the best way to stop –
Clarence Thomas was with these guys way before that. Mm-hmm. And if you get Scalia replaced and then you get another justice, one of the liberals, I mean, this is one of the things – for the Trump presidency, you get that Texas case again, and it can go the other way.
It's interesting too that this kid is going to a charter school, and it emphasizes a point, and that is the charter schools are public schools, so they're treating the charter schools as though this kid, because if you're a white kid in Pattonville, you can go to St. Louis to go to a charter school, and so they are part of the public system. We have this other case going involved the question of whether the school district of St. Louis gets all the sales tax money that was approved in 1999. Mm-hmm. But I think it's pretty clear from the way charter schools are treated that these are public schools. They're publicly funded. They have local resources plus the state aid.
So more to come.
Yeah, Bill? I mean, the voluntary interdistrict choice people make a pretty good argument that they don't get to decide who goes to the charter schools. Charter schools didn't exist at the time of the 1999 settlement, and so it's not it's not even like within their power. Plus, it's my impression that the student is claiming she doesn't really want him to go back to the charter school right away. So I'm not exactly sure.
Because of the mid-year situation. Right. I think he wants to go back to the school or at some point
But or be able to.
You don't want to get shifted in the middle of the school year, no matter who you are or where you are, because that's just a horror show for a lot of kids.
And if you don't believe Mike Wolf, ask Melania Trump, who is continuing to live in New York for until young Barron finishes the school year.
And the Obamas are staying in Washington, D.C. until their younger kid graduates from high school.
All right. All righty. Well, we're going to leave it at that. And I want to thank you all so much for being with us. Interesting discussion today. Mike Wolf, great to see you again. Congratulations on your retirement, if we can even call it that.
I'll flunk it again, Don. I've said that before, and I'll say it again.
Well, I've done it before.
I
hope you're back with us soon. Bill Frivel, but thank you for being with us. And Mark Smith, of course, it's always great to see you as well. And I wish you all a very happy holiday season.
Thank you.
Archived versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org/stlonair. St. Louis On the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.